Okay, Dan Brown's book, The Da Vinci Code, has put the question of Jesus back on the agenda of popular culture. So thank you for taking time out to think about who Jesus really was. If you've not read the book yet, The Da Vinci Code, then allow me to summarize it in like one line, if that's possible. The book tells of a murder in the Louvre in Paris and clues in Leonardo da Vinci's Last Supper painting lead to the discovery of a secret protected by a shadowy society which could shape the foundations of Christianity. Now, if you've got this scratch card, you can see these 10 central claims made by the characters in Dan Brown's book. And perhaps as we just run through them now, you might want to just make your choices and think, yeah, I think that's a fact or that's fiction, whatever. And then if you scratch off, you can find out whether that's right or not. So let's just run through them. There's claims 1, 2, and 3 we could group together to see that they pertain to Mary Magdalene and her relationship with Jesus. There's claim 1. Mary Magdalene had a place of significance in the group that followed Jesus of Nazareth. Claim 2. The marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene is a matter of historical record. Claim 3. The church knew from the earliest days that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had had a child. Okay, now claims 4, 5 and 6 focus on the nature of the Bible and other documents that claim to be gospels or biographies of Jesus. So let's look at those. Claim 4, other gospels, accounts of Jesus' life, besides those in the New Testament, have been discovered in Egypt. Claim 5. The secret gospel of Philip tells us that Mary Magdalene used to kiss Jesus. Claim 6. The Roman Emperor Constantine was responsible for deciding the Bible as we know it. Okay, there's a third set of claims, 7 and 8, that are directed at the identity of Jesus of Nazareth, or rather, the way in which the church spoke about Jesus, what they thought about Jesus. So look at claim 7. The bishops of the early church met at the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD to discuss Jesus' divinity. Claim 8. Prior to the Council of Nicaea, the church believed that Jesus of Nazareth was just a mortal prophet. And then finally, claims 9 and 10 focus on the life, art and beliefs of Leonardo da Vinci himself. And if you look at those two, Leonardo, claim 9, was a member of the Priory of Sion, a secret society which knew about Jesus' child. And then claim 10, Leonardo's painting of the Last Supper shows Mary Magdalene next to Jesus. Okay, well, those are the claims. If you've got a card, you can keep them before you. Well, we'll just kind of run through them as we examine them more closely. So these first three claims that deal with Mary Magdalene. The first of these claims is a fact. Mary Magdalene is a significant person who followed Jesus of Nazareth. When we read the original eyewitness accounts for themselves, we discover her significance. So, for example, in one of the Gospels, Luke chapter 8, from verses 1 to 3, I won't read them, I'll just tell you what it says, but you can check it out for yourself. Luke chapter 8, verse 1, tells us that Mary Magdalene had been cured by Jesus, and she, together with some other women, basically bankrolled Jesus and the apostles. They were the financial backers for Jesus and the apostles. Furthermore, Mary Magdalene is mentioned in 8 lists of people in the Gospels, and in 7 of the 8 occasions, she is first in the list. One other thing about her, she was the very first person to meet Jesus after his resurrection from the dead. So there we go. She was a significant person in that early group of people who were with Jesus of Nazareth. But claims 2 and 3 take us to a very different place. Is it the case that she was Mrs. Jesus? Well, these claims are pure fiction. There is not even one reference in any early church document that Jesus was ever married at all, let alone married to Mary Magdalene. Furthermore, even the later secret or Gnostic Gospels, which we'll think about in a moment, even those documents never mention this idea. And that is most important because the major claim of this novel is that these alternative Gospels treat the marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene as a simple matter of historical record. None of these documents, no church documents, none of the later Gnostic documents ever mention anything of the sort. Let's move on to the next set of claims. Let's begin with claim 4. It is true that alternative gospels or accounts of Jesus have been found in Egypt. In 1945, a large jar was discovered by two brothers as they were digging near Nag Hammadi in Egypt. Within the jar were more than 50 ancient documents. These documents are referred to as the Nag Hammadi Library. Again, you can get a copy of that, of all those documents, the Nag Hammadi Library, published in this definitive edition by Harper. And if you're at all curious, you can get them, have a read of them, see what those later Gospels were like, what they said. Now, far from being accounts of Jesus from the first century AD, these documents were written between 200 and 350 AD. That is, between 170 and 320 years after Jesus of Nazareth. These alternative stories of Jesus were produced by a movement called Gnosticism, like Gnosticism, from the Greek word gnosis, meaning knowledge. So that was a movement, and they produced them in the latter part of the 2nd century AD. Gnosticism existed before the time of Jesus. It's a collection of religions that believed that everyone is divine and has divinity within them, and that you can, if you get the right knowledge, hence gnosis, you can make your spiritual ascent. So these religions in the late 2nd century began to latch onto the story of Jesus as a way of presenting the Gnostic message. It's slightly misleading to call them secret gospels, as if they have been covered up in some way. Again, if you read the church leaders, the Christian writers of the 2nd century AD, they openly write about these documents, these Gnostic gospels. They do book reviews on them as they come out, and you can read them. These Christian leaders of that period write books and letters warning people not to get distracted by these new fictional accounts, but to stick to the original eyewitness accounts. So I'll give you an example of one of these kind of book reviews of one of these Gnostic Gospels. This is from a church leader called Irenaeus, who was a bishop from France in the 2nd century. And this is what he says. The followers of Valentinus, putting away all fear, bring forward their own compositions and boast that they have more gospels than really exist. Indeed, their audacity has gone so far that they entitle their recent composition, The Gospel of Truth, and that's one that you'd find in this collection, The Gospel of Truth, though it agrees in nothing with the Gospels of the Apostles. So there you go. They were widely known about. The book reviews were, damning book reviews were done on these fictional accounts of Jesus. Now, another question can be addressed here. Are the Gnostic Gospels examples of a kind of early feminism? If you've read this, there's this idea in it that there's this kind of original Gnostic Christianity that's a kind of feminist movement from that period. Well, in the original accounts of the historical Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, we find Jesus, the real Jesus, cutting across cultural barriers in order to show the true dignity of women. But in the Gnostic Gospels, we find some truly offensive comments about the dignity of women. For example, one of the most famous of the Gnostic Gospels is called the Gospel of Thomas. Again, you can find that in this collection. The very end of the Gospel of Thomas, I'll just show you the very last bit. You could just flip straight to it if you got the book. The very end of the Gospel of Thomas, it concludes with this exchange. Simon Peter said to them, "Make Mary leave us, for females don't deserve life." Jesus said, "Look, I will guide her to make her male, so that she too may become a living spirit resembling you males. For every female who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven." Now, for me, far from celebrating the sacred feminine, I think that's a major departure from the teaching of the historical Jesus. Now, claim 5 on our scratch card is that the Gospel of Philip, again, one of the documents from the Nag Hammadi Library, one of those later 2nd century compositions, refers to Jesus kissing Mary Magdalene, or her kissing him. Well, it's kind of true, but it's not quite what we find. In the Da Vinci Code, the quotation is given as, "Jesus loved Mary Magdalene more than all the disciples and used to kiss her often on the mouth," giving the impression, oh, she must have been his wife. However, that the Gospel of Philip, which anyway is one of these later books anyway, but what it actually says is that Jesus, the word mouth and the word often are not in the manuscript. So it's Jesus used to kiss Mary Magdalene on her blank. So, you know, head, hand, cheek. But the Da Vinci Code puts mouth to give the impression that it's his wife. Now, what of claim 6? That it was the Emperor Constantine in 325 AD who compiled the Bible as we have it today. Well, the question of which books were acknowledged as part of Scripture was not on the agenda of the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD. Again, I invite you just check these things for yourselves. Keep all the documents from the Council of Nicaea. You can read those documents. You can read the minutes sort of that council and what conclusions they reached, what was on the agenda. There was nothing on the agenda at any point about what books should be included in the Bible. The only contribution made by Emperor Constantine on the subject of the Bible was that he asked and paid for Bishop Eusebius to make 50 copies of the Bible and distribute them around the empire. He did not determine what books were to be included in those 50 copies. He accepted that the church had already recognized which books had the authority of the original apostles. That's the facts of the Council of Nicaea. There was no collection and burning of alternative books. The Gnostic Gospels had long since been seen for the dangerous fictions that they are. Okay, this leads us on to claim 7 and 8 of the Da Vinci Code. Claim 7 is true. The bishops and theologians met at the Council of Nicaea in 325 to discuss Jesus' divinity. But the discussion at the council was not about whether to think of Jesus as divine or not. Everyone agreed Jesus was divine. The question was, what kind of divine life did Jesus have? What kind of divinity was he? That was the discussion. Was Jesus just as divine as the Father in heaven, or did he have a kind of a lesser kind of divinity? So that was the discussion. Nobody thought he wasn't divine. The conclusion was that, based on the testimony of the scriptures, Jesus had exactly the same kind of divine life that God the Father has, and that conclusion was expressed in a specific formula called the Nicene Creed, and it was approved by 318 votes to 2 votes. In the Da Vinci Code, that's described as a close vote. Again, fiction. The Da Vinci Code claims, claim 8, that before this council, the church viewed Jesus as simply a mortal prophet rather than as divine. Again, this is complete fiction. The very earliest Christian documents are unanimous in their affirmation of the divinity of Jesus, both within the New Testament and the immediate next generation. So I'll pick someone from that generation after the apostles. Ignatius, a second generation Christian, wrote a series of letters around 110 AD. Again, you can check out all these documents for yourself. They're all available free on the internet. Ignatius letters, 110 AD. Now, in those, 7 times in those letters, he says, "Jesus Christ, our God." He speaks of the blood of Jesus as the blood of God. And he describes Jesus as God incarnate. There are genuinely hundreds of quotations like these from the writers of that of the period, 2nd century, 3rd century, whatever you want, and you can easily check those for yourself. So it's just a fiction to say that those people before them of Nicaea didn't think of Jesus as divine. The final two claims of the Da Vinci Code relate to Leonardo da Vinci himself. Claim 9 about the Priory of Sion. The modern myth of the Priory of Sion was created by a Frenchman called Pierre Plantin. Plantin and his friends called themselves the Priory of Sion. Now, the claim in the book is that this is like 1,000 years old, this organisation, and, you know, was involved with the Knights Templar in the Crusades and so on. In fact, the Priory of Sion was founded in 1956, and there are the foundation documents. You can look at these on the internet. Loads of people have posted these up. Priory of Sion, 7th of May, 1956, so almost exactly 50 years old. And here's the signatories of these relevant guys. That's when it was founded, the Priory of Sion. He believed that Jesus' bloodline was preserved in the French kings. He believed that he himself was the rightful to the French throne. He and his friends placed thousands of forged documents in libraries all over France to give the impression that their society had existed for 1,000 years. In 1993, during an investigation into financial problems, Plantin admitted under oath that he had forged all these documents about the Priory of Sion. If you want more on that, if you go to the Wikipedia site, there's a fantastic article on the Priory of Sion, if you want all the details. The idea that Leonardo da Vinci was a member of the Priory of Sion, that's claim nine, was simply comes from one of Plantin's forged documents. There is no genuine historical evidence, obviously, for this in any way. Okay, we're nearly at the end. Claim 10 is also false. Art historians do not think that the figure seated next to Jesus is actually Mary Magdalene. Well, there's the relevant painting. Let's zoom that in. There's Jesus and this reclining figure next to him. Remember, the painting is based on John's Gospel account of the Last Supper. In that, John 13, verse 23, John is described as reclining next to Jesus. And so the painting, you would assume, that's John, that's Jesus. So it's just, it seems quite consistent with the account in John's Gospel. Well, here it is. This is the Da Vinci Code. This, who is this? And the claim in Dan Brown's book is, that looks too much like a woman to be John, so it must be Mary Magdalene. Is that the case? Well, art historians do not believe that is Mary Magdalene. They note how Da Vinci paints certain men in a very feminine way. For example, if you think, who is the most macho man in the whole Bible? It probably is John the Baptist. This is a guy who lived out in the desert and wore camel hair and eat crickets and things, or locusts. And, you know, he's a really, really macho man. Now, what I'm going to show you next is Leonardo da Vinci's painting of John the Baptist. Okay. That is Leonardo da Vinci's painting of John the Baptist. So, okay, I would put it to you that there's a certain pattern emerging about the way he paints particular characters from the Bible. Looks, I don't know. Yeah, I think that speaks for itself. Now, none of Leonardo's contemporaries thought that he painted Mary Magdalene next to Jesus. We've examined then the different claims made by the Da Vinci Code, assessing the fact or fiction in them. Don't just accept my opinion for anything that I've said. The historical documents are all available for you to study for yourselves. There's a website address on the back of the postcard where you'll find links if you want to do further research. I think we can see, in conclusion, why this, if you're going to Waterstones, why this is in the fiction section and why this is in the non-fiction section. I think we can see why. While the Da Vinci Code tells us of a Jesus that is certainly not worth bothering about, the Bible's claim, which seems to be true and genuine claim, talks of the true historical Jesus, who is infinitely important and definitely worth bothering about.